Something we experience a lot in our culture is decision fatigue, having so many options and feeling exhausted by it. But picking out what to wear shouldn't be that overwhelming. And that's why I love Quince. Getting dressed is just easier when you have well-made basics you actually want to wear. Quince specializes in high-quality essentials like ultra-soft organic cotton, premium Mongolian cashmere sweaters, and premium stretch denim starting at just $50. They have that elevated feel without the luxury price tag. Lately, I've been reaching for their silk camisoles in different colors because they instantly make an outfit feel more polished. Quince is able to offer prices that are 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They also carry very high quality but affordable home goods as well. Upgrade your everyday. Download the Quince app for app exclusive offers or go to quince.com/POR. Get free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada and the UK too. That's quince.com/POR.
If you're anything like me and you love finding books that completely pull you into another world, I have a recommendation for you. I recently read The Dare by the New York Times bestselling author Harley LaRue, and I totally get why this book has become such a viral sensation. It's the dark romance prequel to the bestselling Losers series and follows a former prom queen and the guy she relentlessly bullied in high school. Years later, they end up at the same Halloween party where one game of drink or dare changes everything. Could not put this book down. The Dare actually made headlines after it was temporarily banned by Amazon for being too sexy before they reinstated. And this new edition is especially fun because it includes a gorgeous gold foil cover and an all-new bonus novella called Ghosted that's never been published before. So if dark romance is your thing, or if you've been looking for the next book talk worthy read, I definitely recommend checking out The Dare by Harley LaRue. You can find it wherever books are sold in print or ebook. What can science tell us about the most ineffable, complex, and deeply human experience? Love. We often think of love as something that just happens, a feeling we fall into. But what if understanding the psychology, biology, and even chemistry of love could actually help us deepen our connections and make more conscious choices in how we love? In this episode, we're joined by Dr. Anna Machen, an evolutionary anthropologist, researcher, and author of Why We Love, The New Science Behind Our Closest Relationships. She teaches at Oxford University and has spent the last two decades studying the science behind intimate bonds. What sets her work apart is its inclusivity. This isn't just about romantic love. Dr. Machen explores friendship, familial bonds, queer love, polyamory, chosen family, and even the emotional connection we feel to pets, celebrities, and spiritual figures. We dive into how our earliest attachments, neurochemical responses, and evolutionary instincts shape how we love and who we choose to love. We also unpack love's more difficult dimensions, why it can be addictive, the psychological risks of coercive dynamics, and how social comparison and modern disconnection can warp our experiences of closeness. This conversation is for anyone who wants to understand themselves and their relationships on a deeper level. Because as Dr. Machen reminds us, love is central to being human. And while it may be messy and unquantifiable, it's also the single most important factor in our health, happiness, and sense of meaning. Remember to go to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a rating and review. And better get a comment about what you learned from this episode. This is The Psychology of Relationships, and you're listening to an episode that may just change the way you show up for love. Enjoy!
What is love and why do we love? That is the focus of our conversation today with our guest, Dr. Anna Machen. How are you, Anna?
I'm good, thank you.
Thanks for joining us all the way from the UK. So let's get right into it because our listeners love talking about science and data yes. and numbers and anthropology. So why, in your words, why is love the most fundamental and unquantifiable human experience?
It's the most fundamental because without it, we don't exist as a species. So it evolved because we needed it, because it infiltrates every aspect of your being, every fiber of your biological being, every aspect of your psychological being, every aspect of your cultural life is infiltrated by ideas about love. And I think it's unquantifiable because however much we know about love from a scientific point of view, which is quite a lot now, mm-hmm. there's always a bit of it we will never be able to touch. And that's the bit that is subjective, because I don't know whether what I say is love is the same as what you say is love. How you're feeling, right. are they even in the same ballpark? We will never know because I can't experience your love. That's the bit that we'll never be able to touch, which I actually quite like that. I think it's good that there's that little bit of mystery left, however much we dig into you know, the science behind it.
That's why we want love, right? It's the mystery of it.
So there is like growing evidence, you know, that human happiness comes down to the quality of our relationships. And there's been a lot of studies, you know, about being lonely, and loneliness is the big endemic, and it's more dangerous than smoking and being obese. Mm-hmm. Like, why do you think this is the case? Like, why is love so essential to our core being?
There's several reasons. I mean, as you're completely right, there's a lot of evidence now about that. Lots of studies are coming out which are showing that, yeah, the key factor in your longevity, your physical and mental health, your life satisfaction, your happiness is the relationships you build with other people. And there's several reasons why that might be. It might simply be that having all those people around you supports you in times of need. So it might be that support you practically, they might support you financially, they might support you emotionally. It's probably because the neurochemistry that's released when you're with them is just so many happy chemicals that it really underpins your mental health. And it's the newest angle on this is the possibility that particularly something like beta endorphin, which is released when we interact with each other, actually underpins your immune system. So there is actually a role in beta endorphin making sure that your immune system is sort of in tip-top shape. So those are probably the main reasons why it's linked to all these positive results we're finding about social contact and health going forward. And I think also, just from my point of view, looking at all the different mechanisms that are involved in love, just because it just engages every part of your being. So when you're in love, every part of your being is tuned to be with that other person, to be as close to that other person as possible. It's actually known as biobehavioral synchrony. And we might talk about that later, maybe. But when you're with somebody else, everything is sort of angled towards them. And I think that's probably got something to do with it as well. It's how we're supposed to be. We are a social species. We are supposed to be with each other.
And speaking of love, I mean, there are different kinds of love. There's romantic love, but there's all kinds of platonic love, familial love, there's animal love. Is there a hierarchy in terms of which kind of love we prioritize?
There's definitely one in terms of what we prioritize. And I kind of, I get a bit like ranty about this.
Rant away.
So romantic love is definitely privileged. Okay. We place it on top of the hierarchy. If you think of all the messages we get from the media, even from our cultures, the idea is you couple up and you know, you end up with somebody. And if you don't do that in your life, then you're some sort of lonely, sad figure. But that's kind of how we prioritize it. And it's strange because there's nothing biological to underpin that, to be honest. So in terms of the benefits of love to you, you will get those from if you love your friends, if you love your family, possibly even something like if you love your God. We need to do a bit more research on things like that. But certainly it's more like a flat spectrum of different sorts of loves rather than a hierarchy. And that's one of the reasons I wrote my book, is because I wanted us to re-engage with that spectrum. Because a lot of the books that have been written before have been unraveling romantic love. And obviously that's really helpful, but they disregard the other sorts of love. And one of the things that makes us human is this amazing array of people and beings we can love. And no other species does it to the extent that we do it.
So I definitely, you know, like I feel like as someone that was single in their 30s, when a lot of my friends were coupled up, having friends, you know, filled a lot of that void of loneliness. And I definitely agree with that. But I can also hear people arguing. And, you know, now being in a couple, I do see how it's a little different. Like you have this person that does life with you more, and it's your partner, where your friends kind of have their own lives and it's not intertwined as much. How would you respond to that? Would you feel that, you know, is it still important to find that romantic love, or can you do life without it?
You can certainly do life without it. I've written recently a lot on things called platonic life partnerships. And platonic life partnerships are all about aiming towards having that companion in life, that person that your life is intertwined with, that person you live with, possibly even decide to have children through assisted fertility. But it's based on platonic love. Mm. And this is certainly something that's starting to happen more within the queer community, particularly amongst aromantics and asexual people. But it's something that's starting to spread into wider communities, into the straight community, where we want someone to grow old with. We want someone to maybe share a house with, share a life with, share memories with, in that very close way. But again, until really recently, that's always been, well, that person has to be romantic. That person has to be a romantic partner. And actually, we're starting to think about that in a different way. Actually, could that person be a platonic person? Yeah. Someone who, because platonic love is very powerful. It's very, very powerful. And certainly we know for women, if we look at things like emotional intimacy, quite often women are more emotionally intimate with their female best friends than they are with their romantic partner. So I think we disregard close platonic love, actually. And it's more about us reorientating our ideas from our culture than necessarily because it's a lesser form of love.
So I think what I'm hearing from you is it's less about like romantic versus platonic, but more about someone that's going to be your like life partner and like intertwine, where I think what happens in platonic love a lot with friendship is it's two people that, you know, there is a love, but they're also on their own paths. But I heard like some of my friends were joking, like, we're just going to go Golden Girls style and all get a home together. And I feel like that you're saying could give you the same biological effects of romantic love.
Absolutely. And it's something that we have had in history before. And certainly some cultures definitely do it. But even if I look at like British history in the Victorian era, there was this thing of spinsters becoming companions for each other. There was this understanding that these spinsters did not want to grow old on their own. And for what, you know, then there were very strict rules about, you know, if you hadn't got married by the time you were 22, then you were definitely on the shelf. And so they would become companions for each other and they would grow old together. Now, I must admit, for some of them, it was a front for being gay when that was unacceptable. But for some, it was very much a platonic relationship that they lived their lives together.
So what do you think is a downfall of, so we observe this, and I've definitely done this myself, is that when you're so focused on finding romantic love, you close yourself off to platonic love, or maybe you just don't work on those relationships as much. What do you think is a downfall of that, is when you're so laser focused on finding romantic love?
You're right. I think if you're very laser focused and you spend a lot of your time trying to find that romantic love, and obviously there are so many tools now for helping you do that, I think we do then start to neglect our friendships. And I think we do underestimate the importance of our friendships actually in our society. They're kind of like the backup relationship, you know, the one you fall back on when, you know, you can't find your romantic partner or your boyfriend or your girlfriend's not around to do something with. I know, I'll go out with my friends. So I think we do neglect it. And I think it's just about a change. And again, that's why in the book I say this is a whole chapter, which is just about friendship. Because I think we need to re-engage with that body of people, that group of people, because they are really, really important. And they're important not just as maybe a counter to romantic love, but for a lot of people, counter to family love. Not everybody gets on with their family. And I spoke to a lot of people who have chosen families, and their chosen families are their friends. And these people are as, if not more, important to them than their blood family.
Yeah, I mean, I think even if you don't not get along, but like I know for myself, like I live across the country from my family. So it's just, you know, proximity alone doesn't allow me to be as close to them. I think my biggest pet peeve is when people are like, I'm going to drop all my friends when I find a romantic partner. That is, I think, the worst. And I guess like, how do you start, you know, appreciating people and like seeing that value that you're saying, that this is just as valuable to my overall well-being, and also not even just the selfish side, I value my love with this person.
I think you need to reflect on those relationships, and I'm as guilty as anybody else of not doing that. But for example, my relationship with my best friend, apart from those I have like with my parents and my sibling, is the longest relationship I've had, longer than I've been married. So we met when we were 10, 36 years ago.
Wow.
And she is still my best friend. She actually does live in Los Angeles. She lives over there. But I saw her again after 2 years a couple of weeks ago, and it was just so amazing. And it was kind of like really emotional. I wasn't expecting it to be as emotional, even with what I study. I think you have to kind of reflect on that. You have to think of the benefits of that relationship. One person, if you're in a, cannot bring you everything.
No,
they right. just can't in a romantic relationship. That's not possible. And you need that hinterland of friendship. So I think it's about positively really thinking about, what do these people bring to my life? What is it that's different about them? Why do I need them? Why do they have to fit together in the jigsaw of who supports me? And certainly, you know, we know again from studies comparing sort of romantic relationships and best friendships in men and women, actually, that friendships bring kind of an unjudgmental, uncomplicated, relaxing reassurance.
Yes.
Because the thing about romantic relationships is that there's always a very, even in the happiest romantic relationships, there's always a tension there, just a very slight tension. And that's because you kind of both know, even unconsciously, that there is competition out there, if you see what I mean.
It's conditional love.
It's conditional.
There is. Like, if this person doesn't do this 100%, I may leave. Yeah. Where with I'm a friendship, out. You would never think that.
You would never think that. It's very rare for you to think that. I think a friend has to do something pretty awful for you to go, actually, this is, we're not doing this anymore. So I think from our studies, certainly that's what that shows. You know, women get this emotional intimacy in this. And a lot of the women I spoke to for the book, it was all about that non-judgmental support. Whereas maybe their families judged their decisions, or, you know, romantic partners had judged them or not been good for them or whatever it was. But their friends had always been there. They're like this rock that you could return to. And one woman said to me, no, they've seen me at my worst. They've seen me at the most revolting, at just the most unpleasant side of my character. Yeah. And they're still here. Yeah.
Do you believe, and because I certainly have seen this in myself, is that when you work on love in other areas of your life that aren't romantic, it actually helps with romantic love. And something that you have research backing this up is our love for our pets. When I got my first pet, Mojo, and I talk about him all the time, this was, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, I've never felt that kind of love before. And that's when I really opened myself up to find my current partner that I can fully love. So I guess it's a twofold question, is what is the love we feel for our pets, and how do the different kinds of loves affect romantic love?
I think certainly, yeah, you can, because again, as you said, romantic love, we might be scared of it. We might have been hurt by it. There might be various things or reasons that it makes us quite anxious. I think the thing about pet love or animal love is it's pretty pure, actually. It's pretty uncomplicated. This thing, I mean, particularly, I don't know, what is Mojo? A dog? A cat?
He's a dog. He's my son.
Absolutely. Well, there we go. So he's a dog. Okay, so dogs are amazing because they live in the moment. They are always pleased to see you. Yes. And the love they have for you is unconditional. They unconditionally adore you. And it's very pure sort of love. And you mentioned that he's your son. Well, when we put people in scanners and we get them to interact with their pets, particularly with their dogs, the bits of the brain that light up are the parental bits.
Oh.
So the relationship we have with our pets is very much a parental child relationship. It's not a sibling relationship. It's not a friendship. It's a parental child relationship.
Is that why people do it like in training? Like, they'll get the dog before the kids?
Oh, I know. Well, I've got my stepdaughter is currently in there, she's got a plant and she's going to keep the plant alive. Then she's going to keep the animal alive. You know, then she's going to have children, apparently. But anyway, so yeah, maybe so. You know, can you, because the thing about particularly something like a dog, which is actually very reliant on you and very bonded to you and very attached to you and does genuinely love you, we know that. Now they are a bit like a child because you have to be there for them. They are useless at looking after themselves, dogs, whereas a cat is, you know, can deal with it. Dogs are useless at looking after themselves. And that is a pure love. And maybe that's why it opened your heart, because there's no games. Dogs don't play games.
No.
You know, they just want to be with you and for you to love them. And I think that, you know, I have 3 dogs and they really are, you know, the loves of my life. I adore them. They are just beautiful. And they bring something. They bring that absolute just calmness and care. You know, we know all the health benefits of being with dogs and being, you know, and the wonderful neurochemistry you get. So absolutely. I think other forms of love can show you maybe the different sorts of love, and they can feed into a more primary relationship. Definitely. Definitely.
Mm-hmm. I'm kind of just like, you know, tying together some of what you're saying. And do you think some of the reason why there's so much pressure on romantic love is that we're supposed to find that one person, where with family and friends and pets, like you were saying earlier, like a friend would have to do something really terrible to leave. And I think it's because it doesn't have to be the only friend we have. You know, we have more leniency towards it. How do you think love with the one, or the way monogamy is set up, is challenging to love?
It is challenging because we aren't, as a species, supposed to be totally monogamous. There's actually no totally monogamous species in the world at all. Even though people go, oh, birds are monogamous. No, they're not. If you watch them, they're always sneaking off and mating with somebody else. So no, they're not. So monogamy is difficult, and it's mainly a cultural imposition on this biological phenomenon that is love, and that is reproductive love. It's very hard because you've got this tension between that social construct that is monogamy. And, you know, most religions preach monogamy. Most legal systems preach monogamy. You know, most of the images you see in the media are about monogamy. And that's the structure that we base our families on in most, you know, in most cultures. And it's a very powerful message, but there's this tension because your biology is not quite pushing you in that direction. And also the idea of the one, this romantic narrative we have, is quite unhelpful because I think it puts a lot of pressure on. There's one person. Yeah. You've got to find a person. And that's not true. It's not like that. It's an algorithm like everything else is. And there's lots of people out there who will fit you because attraction is very complicated. But we have this message of the one. We also have this message of that it's all going to be, you know, sunshine and roses and butterflies and Disney and all this kind of thing. And again, it's not. It's hard. All relationships are hard and all relationships take work. And also, again, within romantic relationships, there is a spectrum which goes from polyamory at this end, where, you know, you love many people romantically, right down to aromantics who don't feel romantic love at all. Right. And there is a spectrum. And, you know, again, monogamy is one bit of that spectrum. And I think we need to understand that we're a slightly more complex species than our cultures would say we were when it comes to romantic love, I think.
Do you think love can disappear, can just be gone in a relationship?
It can. I don't think it happens in an instant. I don't think you can. I mean, some people say, I woke up one day and I decided I didn't love them. But if you look at that trajectory that reaches that point, there will have been a general withdrawal has occurred. But yes, certainly love can completely disappear. Mm. You know, there are two elements. If we look at the biological dimension of love, there are two elements, really. There's the neurochemistry, which addicts you to the other person. Mm-hmm. And then there's the psychological role within that, which is that when we fall in love with somebody, we subsume them into our identity. That relationship becomes part of our identity. So suddenly your identity is not single woman, it's person in a couple. And the fact that you're in a couple with that particular person becomes part of your identity. Right. And your identity changes because of that. So when you fall out of love, generally, if you are the one that's kind of ultimately going to call the end to the relationship, what you tend to see with people when you observe them is they slowly start to physically withdraw. And it might be because there's something about the person that's annoying them, or, you know, they've both changed too much or whatever. Whatever calls them to be fitting together, they're not fitting together. And so first of all, you get this withdrawal of neurochemistry, and that is like going cold turkey very slowly. You know, when you come off like an opiate off heroin, you withdraw slowly. That's what tends to happen in relationships, is you slowly withdraw and those levels go down and you're just not addicted to the person the same way anymore. Hmm. And then you have the psychological withdrawal as well, which can mean even if you are the person doing the dumping, as we call it, you still will feel a form of grief. You still might feel some psychological pain, because even though you've decided that this is not what you want, you've still got to detangle that person, that relationship, from your identity. And so that can still be quite difficult. And then obviously, if you're the person who just comes completely out of the blue, you had no idea there was a problem, and somebody suddenly says to you, this is it, I don't want to do this anymore, then that's incredibly painful, because you go from being up here with all your lovely neurochemistry, feeling wonderful, feeling euphoric, all your aches and pains are being hidden by lots of lovely neurochemicals, and then suddenly you're right down here, you crash, and you go completely cold turkey immediately. And that is why if you are dumped, it's so psychologically and physiologically painful, because one of the chemicals that underpins love is beta endorphin, and that's your body's painkiller. So when it's gone, it really, really physically hurts as well. And then obviously you then have the psychological grief.
But when the love is gone, can you get back the love? Can you fall back in love with someone?
Depends. I think it depends how badly it's gone. I think, there's always a reverse. People always change again. People at different, you know, we all, I think, know of people who are at different stages of life, and maybe right now it's not working, and then they meet again in 20 years' time, and it's actually, now we are at the right. Because coming together is not just about all those chemicals and that physical attraction. It's about all those other things that are also in the mix. Am I at the right stage of life? Do we want the same thing? Is my family happy with this relationship? What do my friends think? I really want to do my career. So there's so many different things that come in that at this point, this might not be right, but in 5 years' time, it might be. Or, you know, you can do a lot of work on yourselves and you can become slightly different people, and then that. So I don't think falling out of love means it's forever. I think in some cases it can come, you can really, or even if you stay together and you're right close to the abyss of it ending, you know, you can pull it back. But I think it takes a lot of work at that point.
Mm. So let's talk about heartbreak for a second, because we're going down that path.
Yeah.
So, you know, you said it yourself, like heartbreak could be completely brutal because, you know, it's grief and it's playing on our biology and psychology, everything, aspects of all of it. Is there a scientific way to like get over it more, or do you kind of just need to go through it?
There are certain things you can do. So, for example, try not to shut yourself in your apartment and never emerge again, because actually what you need to do is you need to try and get that neurochemistry from another source. So yeah, fall back on your friends, see them, get that interaction from them. I always say to people, there are many things that produce those neurochemicals which aren't love. So for example, dopamine. So dopamine is one of the hormones of love. You can get dopamine from lots of other, doing anything you really like. So for example, hugging your dog is really good.
Yes.
Because you're going to get that hit of neurochemistry from your dog. Eat some chocolate. Chocolate produces dopamine. Red wine produces dopamine. All these things. Exercise is really good for beta endorphins. So if you can, go out and exercise. And it's a case of trying to get that neurochemistry from somewhere else to allow you to withdraw nicely. The psychological thing is really hard, I think, to deal with. And for some people, that's just about processing in their own time. For other people, that is really about talking it through. Let's really talk it out. And that's, again, when your friends can be really valuable. That sort of rock that's always been there. You can go. And sometimes people find, you know, reflecting on the relationship, you know, is it a pattern of relationships? Am I doing the same thing over and over again? Okay, well, if that's not helpful, what do I want to do about that? So that, you know, that can be helped. But no, the psychological bit of falling out of love is generally much harder than the neurochemical bit to deal with.
Do you think that love is relative to our life experiences? Because I think back to when I was even in high school, I was so in love with my first boyfriend. But now looking back, I'm like, was that even love?
Yeah.
Because that's not the love I recognize today. I guess it's like sometimes we question if we are in love, but I guess if you feel like you are, then you are, right? That's the state of being in love.
Yeah. I mean, this is the difficult thing, because we as humans, if I say to somebody, are you in love? And they go, yeah, I go, okay. And the thing is,
that's the truth.
As you say, compared to, yeah, that's their, and that, again, it's a point I make in my work and in my book, is that we can't question somebody else's pronouncement that they are in love. Mm. If that, at that moment, they say they're in love, okay, fine. Now, it could be that later on in life, you discover a more intense love, and then you go, oh, actually, maybe that wasn't. Yeah. But in a way, it was.
Mm-hmm.
Love is not a, it's here, it's not here thing. There are different levels of love. In the same way, for example, you know, yes, dogs and people, it's a parental child love. But most people, when they have kids, do feel more powerfully for their kid than they do for the dog. Okay.
Right.
So there are intensities of love. So I think it's difficult to say that you weren't in love when you were at high school.
Mm-hmm.
Because you were in a form of love, a form of your spectrum of love. But the intensity of love maybe you feel later is more powerful. Because there are different, you know, I have two children. The love I have for them is, yeah, really powerful.
Mm.
And, you know, yeah, I mean, you know, I'm that mama bear who would literally kill for them. So it's kind of like, and that's a really, but I wouldn't say that then devalues the other loves in my life, that love I have for my husband, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just different.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Different love.
Different sorts of love. I think the most time I've been challenged by the idea of whether somebody is in love is when I've looked at people who live in abusive relationships, so intimate partner violence. And I talk about this in the book because I think the darker side of love is important to look at. Talking to people who've been in those relationships, looking at studies of people who've talked about where love is in those relationships. And they will say, well, yes, I love, even though the partner's doing awful things to them, they will say, yes, I love my partner. Now, a lot of people go, well, of course they don't. You know, there's no way, because that's just, how could you love somebody who would do that to you? But I don't think you can discount someone else's experience and say that's not love.
So I want to go into the darker side of love because, you know, abusive relationships, verbal abuse is a thing, and physical, of course, it's not just physical. And then, you know, there's the deception, the lying, like all these aspects that, you know, is not good things to experience, yet they're kind of maybe sometimes the outcome that happens in some love instances. You know, can you kind of describe, I mean, I know every instance is different, but like what happens with someone's like chemistry, like brain chemistry, when they're in a situation like this, of like, how do you balance kind of the good aspects of love with these parts that, you know deep down aren't good, but you're still in it?
That's really difficult to unpack, to be honest. It's, I mean, the dark side of love comes from the fact that we are so evolved to look for love and to keep love and to want love. It's kind of like a visceral part of us. And if we don't have it, then we are like half a person. But because of that, because we need it so badly, people can use love to manipulate us. Mm. And we are the only animal on earth that uses love to manipulate. No other animal does it. So because of that, you know, you can, you know, the classics, you know, if you loved me, you would do this kind of thing, yeah. Which some of us might have said jokingly, but some people say that very seriously, you know, and that's why it can be used to control. And someone asked me about this the other day. I said, well, surely that's like maladaptive, you know, because that's actually going to threaten your survival. And it's like, well, yeah, no adaptation is 100% positive. And so the vast majority of love is a good thing. But there's this part of it that is negative, that is survival threatening in certain circumstances. It's really hard because some of us are more predisposed, maybe by our upbringing in particular, to be drawn to people who are more likely to do that to us.
Got it.
And we might be less equipped to recognize it and to be able to go, okay, this balance is wrong and this is not healthy. So it's a really, you know, the question as to why people stay in abusive relationships is a really difficult one. A really interesting study recently, which was done in South Africa, said one of the things that might keep women in romantic relationships, particularly young women who are in abusive relationships, is the romantic narrative and this idea that we tell them that, you know, romantic love is difficult and it's a bit like a roller coaster and you have to get over all these hurdles to have your romantic love. Yes. And you might have to, it's hard and you might have to go against your family's wishes, but real love will triumph and all this kind of rubbish. And we tell people this, and so that when they're in this relationship and, you know, like, for example, you know, the hurdle is actually, oh my God, I get beaten every day, or my family, I'm defying my family, even though my family are saying this person is so bad for you, you have to leave.
Right.
So the romantic narrative itself is quite unhelpful. Or the idea that there is one. Well, my one happens to hit me, but this is the one.
Right.
And, you know, you hear that. There's a very good study of women who are in abusive relationships along those lines, who say things like, you know, but I know him and I know who he is. And first of all, I think my love can change him. So they feel there's this amazing power that their love can change this person. I can rescue him. He's a really good person. He's just not understood, and I can rescue him. And there's all these stories about the power of love. And it's really difficult. But I think it's something you have to recognize, that as with, you know, grief is the price you pay for love, then I'm afraid this horrible end of it where people manipulate and abuse, using it to trap you, is also the price, I'm afraid.
Don't you think there's also a biological factor to this? I've read research about how love makes you dumb. I mean, literally clouds your judgment and you don't see the red flags and you just want to see this person for their good and not their bad. Don't you think there's an aspect of that that's just like, the narrative aside, we're just biologically also not seeing these things?
That tends to happen only though in the very early months of a relationship. So people who've been in long-term relationships for a long time, that's pretty much dropped by that time. But yes, when you are first in love with someone, the bit of your brain which it's called theory of mind, and theory of mind is the ability to tell what somebody's going to do next. You need theory of mind to spot a cheat, to spot a liar, to spot people who are not being who they say they are. So it's that kind of reading mind. Who is this person really? That's known as theory of mind. And when you fall in love, that bit deactivates. So love is blind. It's genuinely blind because that bit stops working. And we were having this chat the other day, trying to go, well, why would that? Because that puts you at massive risk, actually.
Yeah.
Because you can't detect these people. But we were just wondering that if it didn't deactivate, humans are such a neurotic species that we would actually never go out with anyone because we would just simply be going, oh no, they're awful. So we have to kind of like shut it down for a bit to give us a chance to actually go out with anyone at all, I think. I don't know, we were kind of joking around, but we were trying to work out why would it deactivate? But it does, yeah. And it tends, you know, so that's why, you know, you might be in a new relationship maybe a few months in and your friends are kind of like, really? Because, you know, they're not that great, are they? And you just literally cannot see it.
Yeah, no. Interesting. So, okay, what about like unrequited love or, you know, situationships where you're really not getting what you want or it's one-sided? Why do people still feel love towards this person?
You know what? That's a really good question and we don't really know. And we don't know whether any other species experiences one-sided love. Because in one sense, we kind of study this in several different ways. We study people who are in unrequited love with people like, let's say, like in the office or something or at school, and you feel this passionate love for them. And it's really hard to know. We haven't really put those sorts of people in the scanner yet and done a lot on them. But we do know, for example, if we look at what we call parasocial love, and that is love for like a movie star or a celebrity or a character in a book or even an avatar in a Second Life game. That's parasocial love.
It's a crush.
Yeah, it's a crush, basically. We're not allowed to call it that anymore, though, because apparently that's not acceptable anymore.
No.
Not in scientific circles. We have to get parasocial love. And parasocial love is a real thing. It's whether or not unrequited love is a bit like that. Is it a form of parasocial love? And we are amazing as humans because we seem to be able to love something without having that interaction, without having that physical interaction. It's like religious love. Okay, religious love is really well researched now. And we know when we put people who are in deep religious love in a scanner, so there's been some amazing studies done on like devout Christians, like nuns, people like that, put them in a scanner, get them to commune with God in a mystical state, and you see the fingerprint of love in their brain. So they love God. It's a genuine thing. And all the prefrontal cortex, which is what lights up when you interact with another being, with another human, lights up. So they think genuinely, I'm in a relationship and I'm talking to a fellow human, but I can't see him, I can't touch him, I can't commune with him. So we are able to do that. Our brain is able to fall in love with none of the physical presence or activity. So probably unrequited love is maybe a similar experience. Is that you don't actually need to get anything back.
I was definitely in a situation like this in my 20s where I actually like felt like I was in love with this person, even though it wasn't a real relationship. And I'm kind of putting it together now. Do you think that I could have just been in love with love? Like, is that a thing?
In love? I don't know, you know. The fact that you zeroed in on one person is probably unlikely. I think if you were in love with love, you'd just be randomly like...
Okay, I just love everyone.
Like, I love everyone. So I think you probably loved that person for a reason. There was something about them that attracted them to you. I think you can be in love with aspects of being in love. So we have people when we in the lab who, you know, we always ask people for their relationship history. And you'll get those people who are always just having six-month relationship, one after the other. And they are quite clearly addicted to the first stage and the real hit of... lustful neurochemistry that stuff, because the neurochemistry changes as your relationship goes on. The first stages is a slightly different cocktail to when maybe, you know, 6 months, a year in. And there's some people who are just completely addicted to that bit and they just love that bit. And then when it kind of starts changing that cocktail recipe and things start to become maybe less based upon attraction and passion and more on what we would actually call love, then it's not so much.
Yeah, what are the stages of love? Like, I know that you go through different stages.
There are really two main ones. So we have lust at the beginning, which some people, you know, get a different academic on, you probably get a different answer, but I don't classify that as love. Okay, so lust is the attraction stage. Lust is underpinned by oxytocin, dopamine, and serotonin. It's got a lot of unconscious activity. So a lot of lust is unconscious. It's in the core of your brain. You know, you see a lot of hypothalamus activity because that's where the sex hormones are. And whilst there is conscious contemplation, there's not as much. And then when you move into love, what happens is we introduce a new chemical, which is beta endorphin. And beta endorphin is an opiate. Okay, so it's your body's heroin. And it's powerful enough to underpin human relationships for decades, whereas the other ones aren't. So we introduce beta endorphin at that point. And passionate love tends to drop slightly and become more what we call companionate love. And companionate love is much deeper. It's what we call an attachment. It's very drilled into your psychology. This is when the person really is part of your identity. You see different behaviors. Yeah, some people, I think, find that transition quite difficult because maybe it's less exciting. It's much more conscious. So you're using much more of your conscious abilities, your cognitive abilities, such as empathy and trust and reciprocity and that kind of thing. So it's a very different sort of experience as to the early stages of a relationship.
I want to dive into this even more, but before we do, let's take a quick break to hear from our partners. So this might be controversial, but I'm not a big meal prepper. I really just like getting something fresh on the table. And when both my partner and I are working all day, sometimes we don't have time to go shopping and make an elaborate dish during weekdays, which is why I am so excited to try restaurant quality protein from Omaha Steaks. They have so many meats to choose from too, with different types of filet mignon, including butcher's cut, wagyu, grass-fed, burgers, chicken, and so much more. And the reason they are so good is that Omaha Steaks is known for their meticulous aging process. And to make it easy for delivery nationwide, they are flash frozen at their peak to give you that rich, juicy, and intense flavor that they are known for. Try the Burger Perfection Flight at omahasteaks.com today. That's 20 premium steak burgers for just $79.99. Plus, get $35 off with promo code BEEF. That's omahasteaks.com. Promo code BEEF for $35 off at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. If your ideal romance has morally gray characters, impossible love stories, and enough emotional damage to keep you thinking about it for days, you need to read The Throne of Broken Gods by Amber V. Nicole. This is the second book in the Gods and Monsters series, and I feel like it takes everything that I loved about the first one and turns it up another level. At the center of the story are Diana, an ancient shapeshifter who's fully embracing her monstrous side after devastating betrayal, and Sam Keel, the immortal god king who still believes there's something worth saving in her. This book had me on the edge of my seat the entire read. What I love most is that the story never really lets you decide who's the hero and who's the villain, and the lines get blurrier with every chapter. I could not put it down as I just love the banter throughout the book. And if you're a collector, the deluxe special edition is honestly stunning, with stenciled edges, full color character art and papers, a designed hardcover case, and an exclusive bonus scene. Pick up The Throne of Broken Gods by Amber V. Nicole wherever books are sold.
Staying present in a relationship might be really difficult sometimes because it's not just one date. It's every night on the couch, every meal, every, wait, what did you just say? Moment. That's where Brick comes in. Brick is a simple device that helps you put boundaries around your phone so you can actually be with your partner. You just pair the device to your phone and it locks distracting apps, and suddenly you're not half listening while trying to reply to texts or checking Instagram. Now, it's not about cutting out technology. It's about choosing presence during dinner, before bed, or when you're having a real conversation that deserves your full attention. Because relationships don't fall apart from one big thing. They fade from too many small moments of distraction. If you want to be more present with your partner, check out Brick. Go to getbrick.app/POR show for 10% off. That's getbrick.app/POR show. What's your opinion about this? Because Julie and I always text back and forth about how we're in a love crisis, where I think people are afraid to fall in love because they know there's hurt on the other end of it, or they feel like it maybe takes up too much work. Do you feel that if we are indeed in a love crisis, if we're not working the love muscles, that we could eventually lose the ability to love?
I don't think we'll ever lose the ability to love, because love is fundamental to our survival. Basically, those people who are finding that so fearful and so, and not getting together, I'm afraid those genes ain't going down any generations. Whereas the people who do overcome that, their genes will go down. And you would probably end up with a lot of people who had a lot of genetics which underpin high motivation to find a partner, that kind of thing, which is a genetic underpinning. So, you know, some people are more motivated to find partners, to be in long-term relationships, to find that they make them happier than others.
Mm. That's part of your genetics?
Interesting.
That's partly of the genetic influence, yeah.
Very interesting.
Okay, so some people are more motivated to be like in a couple than others. Some people find it a much more satisfying and happy place to be. So, you know, I'm afraid those people would carry on down the generations, and the other guys who were like, yeah, no, I don't want to do this, wouldn't reproduce.
I always thought that was your upbringing more than your genes.
Do you know what? It's a really difficult and complicated relationship. Oh. One of the biggest studies we ever did at Oxford was on the genetics that underpin love.
Wow.
And it's a really complicated relationship. So no, your upbringing is really important, particularly because your upbringing really influences the structure of your brain and influences things like how much gray and white matter you have in relationship areas of your brain. Your baseline levels of neurochemistry, for example, that kind of thing, are affected by your upbringing. But there are certain things that also have a genetic influence. And then there's this really complicated environmental genetic relationship. So, for example, the oxytocin receptor gene, which underpins oxytocin's ability to operate within your brain, has 26 point mutations on it. And each of those 26 point mutations have an influence on your love relationships. Okay.
Huh.
So that underpins a lot of the variability we get between people. The biggest thing that interests me in love research is why we are all different.
Mm-hmm.
So what makes us different? And part of that is your genes. So there is a part of that, part of one of those point mutations influences how motivated you are to be in a long-term relationship.
Interesting. I feel like we always talk about attachment, but we don't ever talk about like the
motivation.
Attachment's
really, really important. Attachment psychology, all that, critically important and really will influence how you behave in a relationship, how you'll feel in a relationship. So your attachment profile is really important, but your genes also have an influential role to play. And sometimes they both interact with each other and then it all gets very complicated. But yeah, your genetics are a really interesting area.
That's fascinating. What are some ways we can awaken our love muscles or ability to love. I mean, I thought I wasn't able to for a long time. The last time I said I love you was in 2009. And then it took another almost 10 years for me to say I love you again. And for all those years, I thought I didn't have the ability to love anymore until I got Mojo. So are there ways we can just awaken those senses more?
Do you know what? I think it's about being more self-aware. So it would be interesting to know during those 10 years what your attachment profile was. Mm. It sounds like you were probably an avoidant personality.
Oh, for sure.
A little bit.
Oh, yeah.
So that's always how. And I always say to people, if you're comfortable, find out what your attachment profile is. Because I think for a lot of people, it really helps them understand their behavior. Mm-hmm. And if you're happy with your behavior and how you feel when you're in a relationship, great. Go with it. If you're not, attachment profiles can be changed. It can take quite a lot of work. Yep. But like, for example, one of the things that changed for you, you got a dog. Okay, maybe suddenly you can't be avoidant with that dog anymore. You have to be there for that dog. You can't just decide you don't want to be there. And that's starting to change your attachment profile. My attachment profile, when I met my husband, I was anxious, really anxious, preoccupied, had high anxiety about being abandoned, was really clingy, nightmare person. He's secure. And I am now secure because I've been with someone who disproved all of my fears. And I'm now secure. So you can change that. So that's always really important, I think, in exercising those muscles. I think trying to maybe practice some of the behaviors which make you more open to letting people in. So emotional vulnerability is really important in finding relationships and also maintaining them. So we know that people who are more emotionally vulnerable, more willing to share sort of their deepest thoughts and fears and feelings about something, are much closer to the person they're in a relationship with than those who cannot do that. And so it's always about exercising that bit. It can be really scary.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are, you know, sets of questions that we give to people to try and help them do that, starting at, you know, really gentle levels of emotional intimacy and vulnerability right down to something that's really quite intense. And you can slowly work your way through and slowly open up that bit of you that allows that person in. So there are things you can do that can certainly exercise that muscle, and also find the love that you want to have.
Right.
Yeah.
It might not be that actually romantic love is your thing.
Right.
It might be that dog loves your thing, or friendship loves your thing, or God loves your thing, or, you know, so look at the full spectrum and think, well, actually, what kind of love do I want in my life?
Interesting.
Well, it's so fascinating that love is so different for everyone, you know, and, you know, that's what makes it hard, like you've said too. And on Yue's example about, you know, taking 10 years to say, I love you again, like, I think this is a prime one. I know we put a lot of weight on those words, I love you, but some people have no problem saying, I love you. You know, sometimes it can be said in a month, where others, you know, it's a struggle. It takes years to actually mutter those words. Yeah. Does that just all come back to like your biology or how you're raised or your,
It's really complicated. Okay, there's never, one thing about love is it's complicated. There's never one answer to any question. So it kind of, partly is what you believe love means. Okay. So what do you think love is? Because we all define love in a slightly different way. Part of it is how we were brought up and how we were shown what love was. Part of it is cultural. There's been some amazing studies. And again, I talk about them in the book about asking people in different cultures to answer the question, what is love?
Yeah.
And you will get really, really different answers.
What are some that you've heard? Yeah.
So for example, if you ask about love in somewhere like Russia, not a good choice, but Russia, the Russians, love is actually quite a difficult, hard, can be quite a negative feeling, can be about distress and abandonment. They're kind of, So love is not necessarily this joyous thing in defined in Russia. It's a difficult thing. If we look at some, for example, some Kenyan cultures, their love is very much tied to God. So love is a spiritual thing. Love is about being on a higher plane. Love makes you closer to God. It puts you on this higher moral plane. So it's very tied to religion. Mm. If we look at somewhere like Brazil, love is the family.
Okay.
So love is about loving your family, providing for your family, turning to your family first. So it really depends where you come from. It's first of all, what you think love is. It's a major cultural component. Some of us are more able to be emotionally vulnerable and say it. Others find it a really scary thing to say. And that might be, again, because of what your experiences of love have been when you were younger. Maybe you loved somebody very much. Maybe you loved your parents very much and you didn't feel that that came back. So, you know, there's lots of reasons why people, and some people just don't put a lot of weight on it. For some people, it's not a very valuable word.
Right.
to be honest. It doesn't mean that much. So that's always difficult. And I know I'm not a therapist, but I know therapists talk a lot about love language to the extent that, okay, what do we both mean by love? Because it could be you mean completely different things. And it's about trying to work out, you know, what we actually mean when we say love.
What about the word falling in love, like that phrase? How do you feel about that? I could see you cringing.
Falling in love is fine. You know, because in a way it does feel like, I mean, maybe the falling bit comes because it is such a rush.
Yeah.
Because the neurochemistry, particularly for some people, is such a euphoric high. All of these chemicals are made to make you feel euphoric and high and happy and all of these different sorts of things. And so I think for some people, particularly people who maybe exist at quite a high level of them, it is a rush. It is a falling. You know, you feel slightly out of control, you know, particularly because that theory of mind bit has turned off. You know, you are out of control. You can't quite assess what is going on. So I think falling in one sense is maybe just somebody trying to explain what the hell it feels like when you get this rush of attraction. You know, for other people, you know, it's more of a slow burn, isn't it? Some people get that rush and fall in love, they think immediately. Others, it takes much longer to realize that actually I am attracted to this person and I do like this person.
That's interesting you say that, because to me, falling in love is a transitional period of when you're not yet in love. But isn't it that you're either in love or you're not? Is there an actual period of like, maybe I'm not? Maybe I am.
No, I mean, love grows. Love certainly grows. But again, it's about, we have no absolute definition for love. It's interesting that you ask that. When I do a lot of public talks about love, and I quite often get asked kind of like for the timetable. So if I meet this person on this day, at what point, you know, does this happen? And then what point does this happen? And then what point do we transition from attraction and lust to love? And it's like, well, there isn't a day. There's no day. It doesn't work like that. Everyone's different. Some people fall hard and fast. Other people, it takes a really long time. There's no absolute, because your experience of love is multifactorial. There are many different things that feed into it, which are unique to you. So we can never say that day you weren't in love, that day you were in love. And I think people who say, oh, I woke up and I knew I was in love, I think they've just come to that conscious realization. You know, their body and their mind have been doing a lot of stuff behind the scenes.
When you're in a long-term relationship, are there ever days that you're just not in love? Like, could that just go away for a day or an hour? Like, how does that work?
Yeah. So there's a difference between being in love and experiencing love, I think. In love is a very active thing where, you know, you stop and think, yeah, wow, I really do love you. And certainly, you know, there are days when I look at my husband and go, I really do not love you today. whatever reason. But love, I think the problem is we misclassify love as an emotion. Love is not an emotion. Okay. It's not even a secondary emotion. It's just not an emotion. Love is a motivation. It's like hunger and thirst. Okay. So if you speak to a long-term couple and you say to them, are you in love? They'll go, yeah. But they don't feel love all the time. In the same way, you don't feel thirsty all the time. Or you don't feel hungry all the time. You feel those things when they are in short supply. So you might feel a desperation for love in a long-term relationship because you've not been with the person you're in love with. Mm. And there's some really interesting new work on this, that love is actually a fundamental life need. So there's a thing called Maslow's Pyramid of Needs. And right down the bottom are things like food, water, shelter. Okay. And then above that, we have security. So the ability to feel and be made safe. And then up there, Maslow, this was 1940, by the way, but Maslow placed relationships and love in the third tier as a psychological need. Well, we now know that actually it's a fundamental physiological need. If you do not have love in your life, particularly, let's say, as a baby, you don't have love in your life, that causes a lot of issues and it's highly, highly detrimental to your survival and your health. So actually, love is a fundamental life need. It's a motivation. It makes us do stuff, but it's not something that's always being experienced all the time because it doesn't need to be experienced all the time.
You know, what about, okay, in today's world, people are getting married later, if at all, choosing to maybe not even have relationships, not having children. You know, we talked about it up front, is that love can come in different ways if you have friendship and family. Is there a world where you could have zero love? And like, what does that mean for our species if that continues? Or do you believe like you'll just continue to find it in different ways?
I think we continue to find it in different ways. There is a real individual variation in this. Some people really do not require many people in their life. And that's partly an attachment style. They're dismissing avoidant. It might be that they live at very low levels of neurochemistry. It could be a genetic underpinning. It could be something, again, that's come from their childhood. And there are some people who are very much islands. And as far as we can tell, they don't seem to suffer that much detriment from being like that. So it is a spectrum in terms of how much people are loving and the number of people they are loving. However, I always say to people, to have absolutely zero love in your life is a really, really bad idea. Really bad idea. And the main reason behind that is because of that very strong statistic now between love, relationships, and mental and physical health and longevity and all that kind of thing. We know that people who don't have love do suffer detriment. We know particularly children who do not have love are set up for a tricky life. It doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be really hard, but they are much more likely, for example, to not have the skills to deal with relationships when they're older. So it's kind of like a lifelong issue. They're much more likely to suffer issues with addiction. They're much more likely to have mental health issues. They're much more likely to struggle in social context. So having zero love, I think, is a tricky, tricky thing. And it's a very risky thing to do. So it is a case of finding that love where it might be. It might be that you find your love volunteering in your community. Mm-hmm. So it may be quite a high level, but you find it with lots of different people. And you find it with that process of helping others.
Right.
You know, it might be something like that. It might be that you're not into like really intimate, like two people relationships, but there's something about being within your community, for example, that you feel loving. Or you might, yeah, just be absolutely animal obsessed and have all these other animals or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
You need that. You do need that interaction with something else as a human.
Love is important. I think that's the main message we're taking away from this. It's actually a basic need. And going back to romantic love, what advice would you give to couples or people dating where they feel like the barrier to love is the three words, "I love you," who says it first? We hear this, you know, from our listeners. It's like, I don't want to be the one who says it first, then I've lost this game of love. I mean, for my partner and I, it took us over a year to say "I love you," and that took a lot of drugs because we were so afraid to say it to each other. What advice would you give to people who are just afraid to say it first, even though they feel it?
I think try to lessen the importance you place on it. I know that's really hard, but it is three words. You could be saying completely different things when you're saying it. And I actually think you read people by their actions more than whether they say it. I can't remember when I said "I love you" to my husband. No idea. I just don't remember it. I really don't. And that's not what you remember. I mean, I've been married for like 20 years. What you remember is what that person has brought to you, what they've done for you. So I think try and don't get so hung up on it. And also, please don't see love as a game. It's not a game.
No. Mm-hmm.
So all these books we get out here, you have to wait this many days before you, you know, message back, and you have to do this and you have to do this. It's like, it's not a game. It's two people who have to find a way to fit together and ride this journey.
Right. Yeah.
And that's going to be really individual to you. So please just go with what works for you and don't try and see it as a game. I think if you see it as a game, you've got a problem because it's not a game.
Yeah.
It's a relationship. It's a give and take. It's, you know, it's a moving, you know, living being. And you kind of have to look at it that way, I think.
Yeah. And what about for the people that are feeling like they're giving up on love? You know, like, I think what you just described is actually the opposite of modern dating. We've been drilled for years about how you play this game. And, you know, you also are kind of like courting each other and only showing your best sides. So then when things don't work out, there's this feeling like things aren't matching up or I'm not destined for the real deal. What advice would you have for people that have almost given up?
First of all, I would be like, if you really, really want romantic love, then please don't give up. If you aren't that bothered, but you just want some sort of love, find another one on the spectrum. There are many different sorts of love. I would say, yeah, dating apps, the whole thing, they have gamified it. They've kind of made it as something else we can do in a really efficient way, which, you know, we can just tick off our list. And we just flip. We go, okay, you know, we might, you know, I've talked to people who've had like 4 or 5 dates in a weekend, not given anybody really more than like 20 minutes, half an hour to decide whether they want to be with this person. Just stop. Okay.
Yeah.
Because the thing about human love is humans were designed and evolved to love in person for a start. So I always say to people, dating apps are fine if you see them as a tool. You need to control them, not them you.
Yes.
So you need to set yourself some rules. Okay. So you need to say, I will have a certain number of like messages with this person, and then I will decide I either see you in person or we forget it. Because otherwise what you get stuck on is messaging and never meeting them. And you don't allow your brain to do its job. Your brain is the most amazing dating algorithm. Okay. It's really good at taking in loads of sensory information and deciding whether or not this person is for you. You cannot do that through a screen. Okay. There's no way you can do that. The other thing it handicaps you with is that ability to spot a cheat or a liar. All those really good skills you have, that those you can't use them online. They don't work. You need to be in the room. You need to use your instincts. Okay. Is this person like genuine? Is this person someone I want to go further with? And you have to, I think, try not to prevaricate too much. The trouble with all this amazing opportunity of all these different dating apps and is you always feel there's something else out there and maybe something better. It's called the paradox of choice. Yeah. We are not evolved to take decisions based upon picking so many different things. It's like, I can't actually compare. So again, it's about maybe taking more time, deciding again, set some rules. I'm not going to just constantly flip. I'm not going to prevaricate. I'm just going to take a decision. And if you can, give them more time. Okay. People are a little bit obsessed with, quite often what I will hear is, I didn't get that chemistry.
Yeah.
I didn't get that feeling. 50% of cases don't get that feeling.
Yeah.
Okay. There is no instant chemistry going on there. What it does is that's just one aspect of attraction, that instant chemical feeling. And that's that unconscious algorithm in your brain, which is lust, which has gone ba-ding. And getting that chemical feeling does not actually predict whether you will have a long-term relationship with that person. That's just lust, okay, guys? Mm-hmm. What you need to do is realize that for some people, it takes much longer. You might be the kind of person who's actually more drawn by someone's brain.
Yeah.
What are they going to say? Are they funny? Do they read good literature? You know, do we have a lot in common? What do they talk about? Actually, the brain is the sexiest organ in your body. So for some people, it takes much longer to get that chemistry than those initial 10 seconds. So give people space and time. And maybe we've kind of made it into a real chore, I think.
Yeah. Yes. It's a job.
Yeah, it's a job. And I think maybe the apps have made that happen. I think maybe if we can step back and reevaluate that a little bit and say, you know, it shouldn't be a chore. It's not something on your tick list to go, you know, by the age of 30, tick, you know, I've got the partner, moving on to the next thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know, try to chill a little bit about it.
Definitely. Well, I love that the brain is your best algorithm. I think everyone needs to live by that. Yes. And sexiest organ, those two. Yeah. Sexiest body part. I mean, this conversation has been so incredible. I mean, there's so many takeaways. I think the first one that comes to mind for me is that love is everywhere. I think, you know, I'm not going to argue. I think romantic love is wonderful, but also the love that you have with your friends and family members and pets, everyone, that all deserve the same amount of recognition almost. And, you know, we hear so many people that are on this quest for romantic love that it's like, I don't need to spend time with my friends. I need to just go date after date. But I loved the conversation we had too, like you saying, by getting Mojo, it helped open me up. And I think the more we can let love in different ways, it one reduces the pressure to find that romantic love. So you'll likely actually probably find it faster because you don't have all your eggs in one basket in the need of just having this. And then second, it just makes you more of a lovable person. So your energy is attracting people that recognize that value. So I think that's the biggest thing I have, is that love comes in all shapes and forms. And, you know, instead of focusing on what we don't have, let's focus on what we do have and build up that abundance. Other piece too is just that we all experience love differently, and that could be person to person or even us in different time periods. And I love there's no right or wrong. And I've definitely been here before too, that I'm like, did I actually experience love with my ex where I thought he was the one, but compared to my current partner, it's not. But it's good to know that, like, it's just a way that you're evolving and your definition of love is evolving, and you need all these experiences to get you to, you know, love the way that you're meant to love. So nothing is wrong in terms of love. It's more of how do you see it and what value can it bring to your life?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, definitely.
My big holy shit moment was the fact that our predisposition to love can be affected by so many factors, including our genetics, which just proves that we can't be on other people's timelines for love.
Yeah.
It's not like I went on 5 dates, I should be in love. We should be saying we're in love now that we're 6 months in. It's like we're all so wired differently that we have to listen to our brain and our heart and our gut of when we feel like we are in love. From our conversation, Anna, I just feel like we often talk about finding love, but love is not something we can find. It's not something we can just go on a website and be like, I'm looking for love today. I feel like love is something we need to feel. And in my example, again, with mojos, the moment I felt the love was the moment I found love. And so maybe we can kind of switch up our verbiage a little bit. Is like, I'm not here looking for love. I'm here to feel love. And we can feel that love in so many different aspects of our lives. And it's not just romantic. And I love this idea of not having a hierarchy of love and not placing romantic love above the other kinds of love. It's just a spectrum. And we should, not should, I don't want to use should, but we can always encourage ourselves to feel the spectrum of love instead of prioritizing that romantic love.
Absolutely. You got it right there.
Well, thank you, Anna, for this conversation. If people want to learn more about your research, where can they find you?
Okay, they can find me. I have a website, which is just annamachin.com. I'm on Twitter. And and also say there's loads of articles and podcasts on the website. And obviously, yeah, Why We Love book is out in America too. So yeah, yes. It's all like summarized in there.
It is fantastic. So definitely recommend reading it. So thank you.
And if you haven't done so yet, subscribe to The Psychology of Relationships today so you don't miss an episode. And we'll see you all next week.
Bye.